Hey East Meets West listeners, welcome to part two of our primers, this week unpacking the ever-growing world of content and content businesses. When you hear content, you may think of businesses like Netflix and Disney, but content is so much more. Right now, companies are battling for our attention, whether it be our eyes for video entertainment, ears for audiobooks and podcasts, or sense of touch with the rise of augmented and virtual reality. To help you understand this new wave of business, we explain in this episode everything you need to know about content, from streaming to gaming and everything in between. Keep listening and enjoy. Welcome to the second primer of the East Meets West podcast, a podcast about Asia tech. My name is Dan. Joining me, as always, Albert. How are you doing?
Dan, I'm good. This is a double episode, so this is part two of our East Meets West primer.
Yeah, it's a little bit weird. The intro still feels a little bit clunky to me. I'm having to read the script. I can't just do it off my head like the old one, but I'm liking it, Albert. I'm liking the way East Meets West kind of rolls off the tongue. And listeners, if you've got any feedback, please send it through. Albert, in this week's episode, this second part of the two-part primer, we're looking at content, which is the second half of what we want to be focusing on for this rebranding of the pod. Similar to the first episode, we're going to break things up in this episode by first explaining what do we mean by content, why is it important, what are the tailwinds that are driving it forward, why we think it's important and fundamental for the future. We're then going to look at a quintessential content business and then finish up by looking at key concepts and metrics to understand about any content business. Albert, to launch us from the top right, when we say content, what are we talking about? Is it just everything and anything?
Look, let's keep it super simple. Content is information or entertainment that you consume. The way, you know, a really simple way to think about it, three different buckets. Eyes, ears, and then I guess body, for lack of a better term for the third one. If anyone's got a better one, please hit us up. But eyes, that's content you consume visually. So video on demand and different types of video, short form video, long form video, whether it's sports content, any content that you're using your eyes to consume, I would put in this category. Then there's ears, so that's really audio content, podcasts, music, audiobooks, so the radio, if anyone still listens to the radio, that's ear-based content or audio-based content. And then I guess gaming, which is kind of the intersection of the two, but you also use your body, whether it's like fingers to hit, keypad, your keyboard, the AB button, your joysticks, etc. Maybe fingers is a better word, but body with VR games and Oculus and things like that, to me makes more sense. And that's anything that you're engaging with your body. Video games is like the classic one, but then virtual reality is obviously another form of content that is taking off, and that's not just video games. So the three ways I think about content: eyes, ears, body.
Yeah, audio, video, and gaming. I think those really are the key buckets. And it's really crazy to actually think about how much of our lives actually can fall into those buckets. You know, so much of this trend towards mobile phones and everyone having one in their hands. There's so much audio and video that we're consuming there, and also mobile games that we're consuming on demand on these products, that it's, to me, like, this is more so even than SaaS businesses, Albert. It's really, really clear to see the trend towards content. And the funny thing is, and one of the reasons I think we've done this pivot and rebrand, is I think content is criminally underdefined and underappreciated as a driving force of business going forward. Even just looking at how traditional businesses are looking to market their material, it's now content-based marketing. You know, like, there's been such a pervasive shift. And where I want to go to first, Albert, now that we've sort of captured the definition, is everyone knows the expression content is king. many people don't realize where that expression came from. That is a Bill Gates, founder of Microsoft, 1996 essay, which I encourage anyone listening to pull it up or put a link in the show notes. It's pretty short. And what he says in that essay is really prescient. Like, it's kind of eerie how he's managed to capture in 1996, you know, 25 plus years ago, what the game was going to be, what the future is going to be. And, you know, a bit of a snippet of what he said: content is where I expect much of the real money will be made on the internet, just as it was in broadcasting. The television revolution that began half a century ago created a number of industries, including manufacturing of TV sets, but the long-term winners were those who used the medium to deliver information and entertainment. And that goes to what you're saying, Albert. What is content? It's information and entertainment consumed by an audience. And we haven't, I think, really seen this kick off. I think we're right now at the precipice of where the digital infrastructure, 5G, internet, payments, all of that are ready for content really to be king.
Man, this is awesome. I didn't realize that that's where the phrase had originated from. And I'm looking at the essay now, and like, they're talking about NBC and Microsoft entering into their joint news business to become MSNBC. Like, it's pretty crazy. This is a really, really cool essay. Great find, Dan. I think it also goes to show that, like, if you're a really good founder, obviously Bill Gates, an amazing founder, you know, you've got kind of two jobs. It's like to see the present very clearly, which is mm-hmm. what he did, and then to see how that present projects out into the future, which he did. So very, very awesome. I think the other thing I'd add to that is, like, everything now is a content business. Like, whether people realize it or don't realize it, like, there is no longer like video, audio, gaming in its own silo. Each of these things fringe upon and touch every other type of business, whether it's, you know, traditional SaaS. You know, those SaaS businesses are producing content in hopes to win customers and build trust. You know, e-commerce businesses are leveraging content to help sell their products. And, you know, a really good example of that is like in skincare, where they use skincare routines mm-hmm. and then, you know, use that to sell. In sport, you know, they're creating content around sport to engage fans. Social media, obviously, a big one with content. And so content isn't just something that's siloed or that people throw into the wind. It is like a core part and basically table stakes now in order to play in the modern century.
So, Albert, let's talk a little bit more about tailwinds and growth potential about content. And I'm going to steal a little bit from Bill Gates' essay here and note some of the tailwinds he was talking of. You know, the fact that we've now got micropayments where, you know, for a few cents or a couple of dollars, you can now pay for things, that really opens up content. You know, I'll be looking at YouTube movie clips, and on the right-hand side, the little panel saying, you know, do I want to buy the movie and watch the whole thing? It's really easy now to integrate access to content and payment for that content, which is why we had the Wild West in the early years of the internet, where there was a whole bunch of content, but no one was monetizing it because it was just pirated, easy to take for free. But now consumers are happy to pay for it because we have the infrastructure set up. Another big feature is advertisements. You know, previously back when in 1996, when Bill Gates wrote this essay, the fact that you'd have a full page advertisement would be incredibly disruptive because your little 36-bit modem would take ages to load the advertisement, which is so much friction. Nowadays, because of the internet and the progressions that we've had, you can have short entertaining videos, which you actually want to sit through as an advertisement. You can have little 5-second ones, trailers. You can have just a little short, small picture, which you can click on for more information. And this just makes the integrated experience of advertisement so much more accepted, which then provides value for businesses who can seamlessly put in advertisements to bolster, I guess, the revenue that they bring in, not from customers. You have more interaction, so interactive games, comment sections, social communities. You know, you'll be watching White Lotus, and then you can go onto Twitter and have this whole community of people to talk about that show and engage with that content on. So there's just so many tailwinds based around just the infrastructure on the internet, the ecosystem that's there, which I think has now pushed content into this stage where it's just taking off and content is everywhere.
Yeah, it's probably worth kind of framing up the monetization model of content in the same way that we framed up like subscription pricing in our SaaS primer, because you've kind of touched upon it there. So, you know, there's generally kind of three main paid buckets of content. So one that you described is pay on demand, which is if you see a piece of content that you want to watch or have access to, then you just pay for that. So there's a YouTube video you want access to, you pay for it. It's a one-off payment. You know, on Amazon, there's movies that you can rent or buy. Apple TV, there's movies you can rent or buy. That's a transactional model. And there's like a subscription model, which a lot of people will be more familiar with, which is you pay for access to the content library and you can watch as much of that content as you want. So Netflix, you pay, you know, $12 or, you know, $15 or however much they're charging now, $25 per month. You get unlimited access to their library. Some cases there might be other like pay on demand things that you need to unlock or pay, such as new movie releases. And Disney Plus does this because they paywall some of their already paywalled content, which is pretty funny. And then lastly, it's very, very rare, but there's like consumption based. It's like you pay for consumption. This is really rare because it's kind of like a perverse incentive, which is like the more you consume, the more you have to pay, which is like you're penalizing the people who really like your content. But so it is very rare that you have that, but that is a consumption and payment model. And then the inverse of that is like free models in which they show advertising or ads to you so that the content and the content you access is free, but the business is generating revenue by advertising.
Yep, and now you're starting to see a mix of those things. So Netflix, you know, famously were not going to ever have ads on any of their platforms, and now they've integrated that in to sort of their basic level subscription, which is still paid, so that you have a combination of advertising revenue and subscription revenue coming into Netflix, and then you have a more premium version where subscribers pay more for the privilege of cutting out all of the ads. So you can see mixing and matching across those models, Albert. So that was a really good overview, which probably, I think, takes us, unless you've got any other tailwinds or growth thematics you wanted to talk about, quintessential content business, Albert?
Yeah, I mean, there's quite a few kind of tailwinds that's probably worth talking about, but I definitely want to unpick like the content value chain before I start to unpick trends, because they kind of fall in and out. So if you think about content, it's something that you're consuming. Audio, video, gaming is probably the three big ones that we think about. It starts with like IP, so like the story. What is the content? You know, whether it's like an original storyline that Netflix has put out, whether it's HBO's White Lotus, whether it is a Mr. Beast episode or like a big Disney animated film, it starts off with this like idea in intellectual property. And then from that, someone's going to create the content itself. So the video, the game, the storyline, etc., draft it out, storyboard it. Then they're going to produce it, so turn it into something that's consumable, turn it into a video that you can watch, you know, play around with the sound, edit it, and they're going to turn it into, you know, a story that you can consume, you know, an image, infographic. This podcast is a great example. You know, Dan does all the production for that. And then there's distribution. So they send it out to different businesses to distribute, or they distribute it themselves. So Netflix, another really good example, is they also do distribution through their platform. But if you're another business like Sony, you'll often just get involved in the IP and the content creation, and then you'll hand it off to a distributor who will then distribute it. And then there's like access and monetization. So you can gatekeep access. You put it on YouTube, anyone can access it. You put it on Netflix, you've got to pay to access it. And then you've got to then charge monetization, and you go through some of the monetization models we've got: on-demand, subscription, advertising, etc.
That's a really good overview, Albert, because I think one of the key things we've touched on when we've broken down companies like Sony, like Netflix and others, is in our view, the best way forward for businesses is to own not necessarily the stack, but definitely the initial part of the stack in terms of the IP and the content creation, because that value is sustainable. If you look at some of the broadcast network television networks, the issue they have is that they're just at the end of that value chain, where all they're doing is they're aggregating content and then they're distributing and selling it on. They're getting advertising fees for the benefit of that, of doing that. But at some point, when the value of this IP is so great that the creators of the IP can also distribute it. And alongside of this, we have distribution costs becoming markedly decreased because of the internet. Now you have a flip where they're essentially getting cut out and the content creators are really coming to the fore, which is why I think we're so much more bullish on companies like Sony, like Disney, because they own the important parts of this stack.
Yeah, I think it's important when it comes to content to understand like what is actually resonating and being consumed by the consumer. And so the thing that is the end product. It's like the IP, it's the video. And so when that's the thing that people really value, people don't value TV networks. People aren't like, oh, I love this NBC channel and how they distribute things to me and they've got 99% coverage or whatever. They care about the TV show, and you can see that because people will flick between TV shows and people will flick between digital media streams. It's all about the content itself. And so when people and businesses realize that's what's resonating with consumers, and they and you know, technology enabled a very cheap and easy way to distribute it at scale through cloud, then the power shifted to IP creators as opposed to distributors.
And what other trends are you seeing, Albert, now that we've got that sort of value chain set up?
Yeah, I like this convergence between creator and business. And so this probably plays towards the front end, which is, you know, the content creation, but also throughout the entire kind of value chain. So if you look at a generalist content creator, someone like Kim Kardashian or Mr. Beast, who we often talk about on the pod, they're creators, but now they're becoming businesses. And so, you know, they've started to monetize their content and their audience in a lot of different ways. You know, Kim Kardashian, she now runs a private equity fund. Mr. Beast has got kind of his Mr. Beast empire. And the reverse of that is also you've got traditional businesses who are becoming content creators. So if you go to TikTok or Instagram, you can see all these major businesses, you know, Woolworths in Australia, they produce content. You know, Nike produces content. You've got these traditional businesses who are now also producing content. And so that's like this convergence of like content creators are now becoming businesses and monetizing their audience. And businesses are becoming content creators by turning their fans or their buyers, customers, into their audience. So it's a really interesting convergence for me.
Yeah, and one thing we talked about just before we started this, Prime Albert, was the idea of trust, which I think was a really insightful observation from you, that you know what these content creators are doing is they're creating content and establishing a relationship with consumers, and that builds trust. And I think in the earlier days, particularly around some of the Instagrammer influencers and TikTok influencers, etc., the idea was that companies would come in and then they would graft off that trust to sell products. And there's definitely a place for that. And I think there's still going to be a place for that. There's lots of people who create content, who have influence, who don't want to go through the hassle of manufacturing t-shirts or a product and those sorts of things, but they're happy to sell their likeness, image, and approval to these products. But I think we're more and more seeing creators wanting to have more control over the products which they're selling. And also, to be frank, the value which those products are producing. So, you know, Mr. Beast could have done an affiliate program with some other burger delivery company. He wouldn't have had any control of the quality of that product. Maybe his customers would have a bad experience, and then that would affect his brand and the content that he's putting out. So he decided to own the whole chain. Therefore, he's got quality control, but he also gets the upside and potentially the downside of that whole business as well as he sets up his Mr. Beast burger restaurants throughout America. So it's a really interesting convergence, as you said, Albert. But I think fundamentally is this idea of trust that you've sort of picked up on.
Yeah, I think if you look at it as like content is either information or entertainment. Like it's and sometimes it's infotainment, which is the convergence of the two. And if you listen or you get entertained by someone, you're going to trust them because the more time you spend with them, the more time you're going to think about that person's views or listen or engage with that particular piece of content. And the more you engage, the more you trust. And, you know, some of these traditional businesses are low trust environments like Woolworths. Like who really trusts their grocery? And you know, suppliers don't trust the groceries and customers don't supply their grocery markets. And so I think that really enables someone like Mr. Beast to come in and like sell, or Kim Kardashian to sell all these consumer products because they've created trust where the other businesses have eroded trust. And so that's fundamentally what keeps people engaged with content is like there's implicit trust that they give content creators. And that's probably something people should think about, is like, as you consume content, like, do I trust this content enough to like have it sway my own opinions and thoughts and how I think about the world?
Yeah, I love this pickup, Albert, because immediately what I'm thinking of is a very well-documented effect where people really trust movie stars who they've never met before in real life. They've just seen maybe a couple of movies. There's such an effect, a halo effect, by appearing on TV, appearing in movies, that people think they've got a real connection with, you know, Kim Kardashian, with George Clooney, Brad Pitt, whoever, and that affects them to the extent that they're willing to buy things. And that really is the essence of what we're talking about here in terms of the monetization, the end of that value chain.
Absolutely. A really great example of this is like Taylor Swift. Like Taylor Swift is a content creator. She creates music. She's also got a bunch of other things that she's obviously working on. But you can see her fans go crazy to buy tickets. And, you know, she's got this cult following to the point where, you know, she's taken power back and created Taylor's version. And we'll talk about that on this pod, I'm sure. But if, you know, Taylor Swift came up to fan and was like, I want you to like give me $1,000. They'll be like, yeah, sure, probably. Like there's probably a lot of fans who will just like do what Taylor Swift says, despite not knowing her as a person or her values, but trusts her so much because of the time they've spent listening to Taylor Swift.
All right, Albert, let's talk about a quintessential content business. I think mentioning Taylor is a good one because we're going to get into Spotify, but maybe I'll lead us off with looking at Disney, which is a company we've looked at. We've talked about their flywheel, and it's just a business model which revolves around the creation of sustainable and scalable brands based on the Disney characters and stories. So famously started off with Mickey Mouse character, the original cartoon, and then they've really, you know, blown out the water in terms of the amount of IP that they've got. Lucasfilms, Star Wars, they've just got this whole universe of characters, princesses, heroes, etc. And really, the business model just has that at its core, and then they profit from that IP through various distribution channels. So you can think about distributing through television networks. ABC is an example, but they can also have their own Disney channel as well. They get revenue through their own distribution channels through ads. They have affiliate fees, parks and resorts. So if we're talking about that whole of body experience, actually walking into a park, Disneyland, experiencing the characters, etc., the rides, toys and merchandise, they're licensing out their IP to manufacturers who are producing toys, producing gear, all sorts of things, t-shirts that people are buying and they're receiving a cut from. You have branded experiences, so things like Disney on Ice. Again, you can go see a show based on Disney characters, movies, cinemas, and more recently, games, which I think, you know, maybe convergence is going to be the buzzword of the pod, Albert, but definitely there's a convergence between media, television, and now those characters coming into gaming franchises, and that's going to be one to watch. But to me, Disney is just quintessentially a business which has got at its core IP that people want to see, hear, and experience, and they've just monetized it in as many ways as possible.
Yeah, that's a great great choice. I've also kind of picked Disney as well. What I've done is I've chosen two companies on the opposite ends of like the content spectrum. So like one is a company, Disney, who create all their IP, they produce all their IP, and now they've really started to distribute that through Disney Plus. So previously they were handing it off to someone else to distribute, but now they're distributing it themselves and then doing the monetization. So they play full stack, fully integrated across that value chain. The opposite end for me is like Spotify, which started on the other end of the spectrum. So Disney started the IP and moved down. Spotify have moved, so they started from distribution and moved up the value chain. And so traditionally Spotify was a business that aggregated music licensing. So they were really like a very legal business. They were like a music licensing business. And up until, you know, no one else had done this. No one else had actually got the legals out and like worked out all the licensing agreements. So I don't think Spotify really gets heralded as like this amazing legal business rather than like a streaming business, but it really aggregated all these licenses and then distributed them through the Spotify platform for people to listen to music. Now they do audiobooks and podcasts. through the Spotify platform. But what Spotify is doing now is they're moving up the value chain rather than down the value chain by trying to do their own production, trying to do their own content creation, and also trying to build their own IP. So Spotify have started to like build relationships and acquire companies like, you know, The Ringer, who they've acquired. They've started to do exclusive partnerships with different content creators to get exclusive access and license to IP, and then support the production. So there'll be podcasts that are produced by Spotify because they're starting to play up the value chain. So two different examples of content businesses: Disney that started at the start of the value chain and moved down, Spotify that started at the end of the value chain and moved up.
Yeah, I think that's a great comparison between the two, Albert. And when you're looking at Spotify, you know, Joe Rogan, an exclusive sort of partnership with Spotify, they're paying for that content, which has been created by someone else, but they're paying for that exclusivity. And that's something which, because they've started at the end of the value chain, they're having to pay that premium. And I think this is one of our criticisms of them as a business, Albert, was because they start at the end, they've got these kind of inbuilt hurdles to their business model where they're having to pay licensing fees, they're having to pay fees for exclusivity. But where you might project out into the future is hopefully they've now created an ecosystem where they can have organic content coming through. And one thing I think of that is like there's podcasts like ourselves, Albert, which Spotify is the premium platform to distribute your product. And so we're uploading our stuff there. There's lots of musicians and singers who likewise, they're not getting label deals for their music, but they're just uploading it on Spotify. And because they're that first point, there's a way, I think, for them to capture that and then monetize that as those podcasts like us become successful and singers and artists become successful as well. They cut out the labels, the middle person.
Yeah, I want to kind of move back onto this point around trust, because the reason why I picked Disney and Spotify to talk about as like quintessential content businesses, and maybe I'll throw in New York Times here as well, is that if you go back to this idea of like, if you create content, you can build trust with a customer. And if you build trust with a customer, you can do other things to monetize that customer. So Disney is a really good example. They create really compelling IP, like Mickey Mouse. People love Mickey Mouse. And so it lets them then build a theme park and figurines and clothing, because people love Mickey Mouse so much, they want to wear a Mickey Mouse shirt. They want to go to a theme park that's like Mickey Mouse themed. They want to have like a Mickey Mouse or Disney princess themed lunchbox. And so that's an example of like, because people love our brand and love our content, we can then monetize in other ways because people trust it and love it. Spotify is also the same, because people, like artists, like the platform, or maybe not like the platform, but have to use the platform, or people like the platform or trust the platform as an end user because it's got all the music that you want to listen to. It lets them do other things. So now they're doing merch. Now they've got podcasts. Now they build playlists. Now they do radio. Now they do concert tickets. And I'm sure there's like a wealth of other things Spotify will eventually, you know, move into. They also do like video on demand. So you can watch a recording of a podcast on Spotify now. And so, you know, both of these companies are companies that have built trust and brand awareness, and they've used that brand awareness to then move into like other parts of the business, other, you know, adjacencies that helps them generate more revenue.
Yeah. And it's not just more revenue, it's cutting out the overheads of those licensing costs that we talked about previously. So check out that episode if you haven't. You know, the fact that they're, I think it was about a 30% clip that they're paying to these providers of content, that's an overhead which I think for Spotify to be its best self, they need to find a way to get rid of that and move up the value chain, as you've said, Albert. I think what's really coming across here, and I hope the listeners are sort of taking away, is this value chain is very interconnected. You know, the idea that you have content and then you have to have distributors to get it to the audiences, to get it to the consumers, are really fundamentally interlinked. And so I think if we want to move now to sort of key concepts, Albert, one of the things I think people really need to understand when unpacking a content business is who are the distribution partners? So an increasing amount of people, of companies are offering products and services and they're bundling them up. But really there has to be sophisticated ways of acquiring customers retaining those customers and then monetizing them effectively. And I remember when we were doing our Roku episode, Albert, so this is the sort of TV hardware, somewhat software company, it really fascinated me that they've basically provided this service where any TV can be made into a smart TV. And then they're leveraging that to say to streamers, if you want to be on the front page of all of these TVs that we're set up with, then you're going to pay us a cost or pay us a fee. And they're going to take a clip from that. And that's an example of not a traditional distribution partnership that you would have thought of, but there are these partnerships out there. If you're a Samsung TV, you might have Netflix pre-installed as one of the apps on the Samsung TV. Samsung's not doing that for free. You know, Netflix is paying for that service. And these are the types of partnerships that for many consumers are kind of unseen, but underpin this business of how do we get one piece of content all the way to the eyes, ears, and fingertips of consumers.
Yeah, it's completely integrated when it goes from like platform distribution to like how do you get Netflix in front of more people, and then content distribution, which is like how do you get this specific thing from Netflix onto your platform. I'd definitely check out the Roku episode because that's a really good call out. But in that episode, I think we talked about like Paw Patrol being like one of the things that when you load up Roku is up on Roku. And, you know, maybe it's on Netflix specifically, but someone has Paw Patrol has to pay to get that onto like the prime spot of Roku. I've got a Google TV. And so when I load up my Google TV, you know, one of the first things on the home screen is like YouTube. And obviously Google can get away with that because they own YouTube and then can distribute that. So it's got like all the YouTube channels, you know, I watch or things that they recommend to me based on my watching habits. But, you know, it's very rare that YouTube is in front of someone as like a key platform. But because Google obviously own it and I own a Google TV, that's like the power of like content platform distribution. And now they're also showing content on that platform right in front of me, competing for whatever else I'm about to watch.
All right, Albert, you got a key concept or metric?
Yeah, so I've got a few, but I think the big ones, if you go back to like eyes, ears, body, is like how often are people engaging with your piece of content? And so a lot of companies like Netflix, they track like view time, so they know how much time is being spent on TV and TV watching, because that gets reported nationally. And then Netflix have obviously then got how much time people spend watching Netflix, so they can see as a percentage of like that total number, what's the percentage of people watching Netflix as opposed to regular TV. So, you know, for example, in the US, Netflix account for about 7.5% of TV time, 2.5 more than Amazon, 1.5 more than Disney Plus. So, you know, that might seem like a really, really small amount, 10%, given how pervasive Netflix is. But think about like how much content's on, you know, Netflix versus how much content, especially like time-sensitive content, is on TV. I think 10% is a pretty good metric and a pretty good performance metric for Netflix.
And I think engagement is an interesting one if I cross over a little bit to our SaaS primer, Albert, because so many of these, the end state of these content businesses is a subscription service. It's really about making sure customers are engaged and happy with the product they're using, because the downside is if they're not happy with the product, they're going to unsubscribe. And engagement, I think we've had this debate. I can't remember which episode it was, Albert, but if people are engaged, they're more likely to keep their subscription. And that's something which these companies are very, very sensitive about, is keeping those engagement rates high. One of the, probably a simple one, Albert, maybe we should have started with this one in terms of a key concept, is just licensing. So for those that don't know, I think people sort of generally know the concept, but it's a content licensing agreement, a contract that allows companies to repurpose, republish, or use material. Where we can add a layer of complexity to this is that once you get into these sort of media rights businesses, and particularly sports, these agreements tend to be time gated. So as an example, if you're the NBA, National Basketball Association, NFL, National Football Association in America, they sign up 10-year deals worth billions of dollars to broadcasters, so these are your television networks. But increasingly now, Amazon's, Netflix, I think Amazon actually got the rights to the baseball you know, they're starting to look at how they can now get these premium sports content onto their streaming platforms and cut out the networks. These agreements, because they're time gated, there is so much hype and buzz and interest as they're coming to an end to understand what's the market, what are they going to be priced at, and ultimately who's going to pay for that content and get that contract for the next, you know, decade period.
I'm sure all the other streaming platforms are kicking themselves for losing the baseball. It's actually funny. I was listening to another podcast that was like comparing like average fan ages in the US to sport, and like baseball, the average fan is like 55. So I'm sure there's a pretty big intersection of people who use Amazon. If Amazon is only like 5% of, you know, total TV time, and baseball, and so good one, Amazon.
Well, it's an interesting one, because I think this is where we should just double click on the idea of these partnerships. When you're a content creator, and I know we used the example of Mr. Beast, you really want to protect your brand and the product that you're producing. And when you provide it over to these streaming services, it's not as simple as just like they now flick it on to the TV screen. All of the production behind it. So if you think of a sports episode, the scoreboard, some of the data and stats that's pulled up, the commentators, the whole production is owned by that broadcaster, or in this case for MLB, Amazon. And if that is a poorly produced content, that will affect the amount of interest in the game, which will affect things like ticket sales to people actually turning up to the events, merchandise sales, etc. So if you're a content creator, if Amazon, just because they've got a lot of money, says we're going to pay you $20 billion for the rights to broadcast, but you've got another TV broadcast that's offering you a lesser amount, but you trust them to deliver a higher quality product, you might actually go with the less upfront cost, because you think we're going to keep control of our brand, we're going to make up the money on the back end through merchandise, ticket sales, etc., those sorts of things. It is a very complicated and complex ecosystem, which is why I think it's just something to highlight. Licensing, distribution, partnerships, these are all a big part of the content game.
Yeah, and the inverse of that is also like investment into content. So if you go to the Netflix Annual Report, you can see how much they're investing in like CapEx back into creating new content. Mm. And so if you're a business that predominantly does licensing is a big metric. If you're a business that plays in like the IP generation and creation production, you should look at how much they're outlaying. And like, spoiler alert, it's a lot of money how much they pay out in terms of producing content. But that's just the cost for them to keep a very competitive structure. I think, Dan, the other thing I want to say is like where we had this disagreement is on Bilibili, where I think you made the argument that like, you know, not everyone's going to watch something daily, but Netflix talk about specifically a metric that they're optimizing is winning competition for viewing every day. And if you're a streaming platform, you want people to be tuning in every single day onto your platform, because that's what drives stickiness. And for Netflix, you know, they talk about this very specifically, always focused on winning the competition for viewing every day.
Nice. Any other key concepts, Albert?
Look, I think we've probably covered, you know, the main ones, subs, engagement, you know, investment. I think it's probably worth kind of looking at the concentration of each IP and different, you know, series, TV, movies, etc., against the total viewership. So like if you remember back in 2020, it feels like a long time ago, like Tiger King was like the zeitgeist of the time. And then last year, Squid Game was like the zeitgeist. So when you look at, you know, total views on a particular platform like Netflix, Amazon, etc., they'll often talk about what actually drove those views. And you can see that those views aren't, you know, normally distributed across their platform where you've got a high concentration in the middle. They're going to be really, really concentrated, you know, power law concentrated at a handful of different titles. And for Netflix at the moment, that's like Jeffrey Dahmer, Stranger Things, The Gray Man, and so, you know, Squid Game last year, etc. So it's always worth looking at like what's actually driving viewership from like a particular IP, because then that tells you like they're going to invest more money, where they're going to invest the money. They're going to create new IP, or they're going to pour money into, you know, this IP that has been successful previously.
Yeah, I think where I'll take this one, Albert, is just to highlight. I think content is such an exciting space because I don't think the rules of the game have really been written. You know, as I led off at the start of the pod, I think a lot of the infrastructure is now in place for content to really go gangbusters. But we all know, like, there's a failure of curation. There's a lot of content. There's not necessarily a lot of good content. Where there is good content, there's a challenge in terms of finding and accessing that content. And what you sort of brought up there, Albert, is I think that there's really a lack of strategy or clarity as to how companies are positioning about this very question of, do you pursue the hits like a Squid Game, like a Tiger King, etc., which might be a strategy where it's like high volume, which I think is what Netflix is doing, churning out a lot of stuff and hoping that one of them just sort of grabs the national global interest? Or do you do something like a Marvel where like you've very clearly like set out this universe strategy to engage people over a decade-long span with an IP that's going to endure and sustain, into this idea of a super fan, which is like these people are now creating content based on existing IP, which then increases that engagement. You know, it makes them more likely to go to theme parks. And a great example, using obviously Asia, is anime. Like the fact that so many people cosplay, dress up as these characters, they'll make fan fiction, fake manga based on these characters, etc. Like, to me, that is a different strategy than the Tiger King, Squid Game kind of one-hit wonder production model. And it's interesting to me how that might play out in the future.
Yeah, I think this goes into my like really only major global trend in the past kind of decade, and I'm sure it'll continue to play out, is like this tension point between original IP and the creation of new original IP.
Yep.
And for lack of a better word, like squeezing the rock of existing IP. And so I'm glad you mentioned Marvel, because Marvel is, to me, the outlier. Like, I think very difficult to do what Marvel and Kevin Feige have done, and kudos to them. But I don't think that is the playbook for creating really good IP. But if you look back in the last kind of 5 to 10 years, like, can you name a net new IP that has become enduring? And to me, it's really difficult to do.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, what came to mind was maybe something like Black Panther, but even then that's from the Marvel universe.
But that's Marvel, so that's like not net new IP, like something that has been created, that people have built a universe. To me, maybe John Wick is probably one where they've made multiple films out of that, but there's no John Wick universe that I think they're trying to do that. Maybe like Hunger Games started as a book. But, you know,
Game
to
of
me,
Thrones
there's
started as a book. Yeah, you're right.
Yep, there's but there's no little like net new IP that wasn't originally like a story previously that people have adapted. And you can see that in what comes out in movie theaters and what comes out in games and TV shows, is people just milk existing IP because they're so afraid of creating new IP because it has to compete, and it becomes really hard to compete.
All right, Albert, I think to end the episode, let's pull out a couple of episodes from the library for people to dive into a little bit deeper on content, apply what we've talked about here to specific companies. Obviously, we've got the Disney episode. We mentioned Roku. One I wanted to pull out, because I think in this episode, we've talked a bit high level. We haven't really gotten into gaming specifically. Check out the Nintendo episode, because when we talk about enduring engaging content that fans just absolutely love, you know, Pokemon Go took the world by storm 5+ years ago, whenever it was. I think Nintendo is a really interesting player in the space because they're very focused on what they do, which is video games. They haven't shown really any inclination to move up or down the value chain. That's one I would encourage listeners to check out and have a listen to again.
Yeah, awesome call out. You know, in addition to kind of the ones I've spoken about, obviously Disney, and then our episode on Spotify. I think a bit of a left field one, which, you know, may not resonate with our US listeners, but definitely listen to our Adore Beauty episode. I know that's more e-commerce, but that really is the intersection of like e-commerce and content. And I think that really frames up like what this convergence of like business and creator is happening and how that kind of plays out in companies.
Okay. Let's finish up there. Thank you for listening to the East Meets West podcast. We'll catch you all next week.